I want to talk to you today about broken down walls. The particular walls that generated this message are the walls of Jerusalem, but each of us has walls in our own lives that need repair. They may be walls in our emotional lives, or in our finances, or our relationships, or our career or personal habits. These walls are structures that provide protection, and they defend us and support us and strengthen us as we face life. If you are hurting today because of some broken walls in your life, what are you doing about it? Are you crying yourself to sleep at night? Are you withdrawing from family and friends? Are you angry? Are you burying yourself in your work or in something else to kind of take away the pain? Those are natural responses, but rarely do they result in the rubble being cleared or the walls reconstructed. Rebuilding rarely takes place without a plan. Do you have a plan? In 586 BC, King Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed the walls of Jerusalem as well as the temple and every house in the city. There was not one stone left upon another. The scriptures tell us that 70 years later, a group of 50,000 exiles returned from Babylon to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. About 60 years after that, Ezra the scribe returned to establish a spiritual revival, but still the physical walls of Jerusalem lay in heaps, resulting in a weak and vulnerable community of God's people. The rubble remained until the year 444 BC, when God laid it on the heart of a man named Nehemiah to return from a very prestigious position in Babylon to Palestine to rebuild the walls. I want us to examine some steps that Nehemiah took to resolve the problem of the broken walls of Jerusalem. They are sufficiently transferable that I believe they will apply to each of our lives in respect to the particular walls that need reconstruction for us. Step one, not surprisingly, is to recognize the need. Now, that may sound so obvious to you that it's unnecessary to mention, but frankly, there are a lot of people who don't even notice the rubble around them. They get so used to broken walls, they assume that that's normal or inevitable. Apparently, that was the case for many of the Jews living there in Jerusalem, for all they had ever seen were piles of rubble. They couldn't even remember what a walled city looked like. I think the same is true of many of us. We fail to even recognize the rubble. Every once in a while, I hear a person say, "My spouse has just told me that he or she wants a divorce, and I didn't even know there was a problem." Well, granted, once in a while, that will come out of the clear blue, especially if there's a third party involved. But in most cases, there was plenty of evidence of trouble for a long time, but a person just didn't open his eyes to see it. Another example may be the person who has a major drinking problem, but refuses to admit it. Or someone who is spending out of control, but will refuse to ask anybody for financial advice. Nehemiah, on the other hand, recognizes the problem of the broken walls of Jerusalem, even though they're certainly not right under his nose. As Jerry pointed out in his excellent message last week, Nehemiah found out about these broken walls when he's 900 miles away. He hears about it from his brother Hanani, and he asks as many questions as he needs to find out exactly what the situation is. We need to, first of all, recognize the problem. But secondly, there's a partner step to that, and that is to accept responsibility. There are those who recognize the rubble, but they develop a victim mentality and refuse to take responsibility. Simply defined, The victim mentality is the outlook which says, my life is essentially at the mercy of vast, powerful sources and forces out there beyond my control. Therefore, I am the victim of and at the mercy of my genes, my IQ, my parents, my teachers, my husband, my boss, the society, the economy, the devil, you name it. The victim mentality ultimately discharges us from any responsibility for our lives, since clearly what is happening to us is not our fault. Now, to be sure, there is a sense in which all of us are victims. There are forces in our lives that we cannot control, but there's a great deal of difference between being a victim and having a victim mentality, which says basically, what's the use? Why even try? Especially there are people in our society, the poor, the downtrodden, who suffer from forces like discrimination and racism and sexism and uncaring bureaucrats. Nevertheless, it is not necessary for a person to take the position there is nothing he can do. There's always something a person can do. There's always a part of life that is under our control if we will realize it. A counselor told of a man who was going through a very difficult time with his wife, and he was thinking seriously about divorce. Tell me, said the counselor to the husband, what kind of problems are bothering you? Well, replied the husband, to put it quite simply, my wife is an angry nag. The other night, for example, she wanted me to go out to a meeting, so I offered to stay home and take care of the kids. I did that. In addition, I did the dishes that had been left over from the day. And when she got home, do you think she thanked me for it? No. She looked in the kitchen and saw there was one pan I had failed to wash. And all she said was, why didn't you do that pan? Very interesting, said the counselor. Incidentally, why didn't you do that pan? Really not a joke. I'm in the middle of this here. In the days following, the husband thought about that question, and a revelation came to him. He realized that every time his wife asked him to do something, he would always leave one little tiny part of it undone. He hadn't created her anger. She had it even before she met him, but he did play into it. And in that sense, he had some control over the situation. He knew how to trigger her anger by leaving one part of any task undone. In other words, he had more power over the situation than he wanted to admit. He was not so much a victim as he thought. I believe that some of the Jews living in and around Jerusalem had developed a victim mentality. Whenever they had made an attempt to rebuild the walls, the enemies had torn them down, so they just quit and resigned themselves to living without walls. Their focus came to be on coping and surviving rather than on living and thriving. Friends, it's not until we take personal responsibility for the broken walls in our lives that any rebuilding can take place. In other words, the need must be translated into a personal conviction that God wants me to do something about these walls. Nehemiah developed just such a conviction, you might even call it an obsession, that Jerusalem's walls were his problem, not somebody else's problem. In verse 4 of chapter 1, after hearing about the sad conditions in Jerusalem, he sat down and wept. In fact, for days he mourned and fasted and prayed about the walls. 4 months later, the sense of responsibility to do something about these walls became so strong that it began to affect his work. The way this is brought out to our attention is through the notice at the end of chapter 1 that Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king. A cupbearer was not just a wine taster. He was also a close confidant. Since kings ate and drank a great deal, the cupbearer was with the king all the time, and he became a very close advisor to the king. The question the king addresses to his cupbearer, Nehemiah, in chapter 2 and verse 2, can be misunderstood if we fail to grasp a certain nuance of a Persian court. The king asks, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." This is not a mere observation on the part of the king. There is an edge to the king's voice, and that edge makes Nehemiah very much afraid. Why? Because you weren't allowed to be sad in the presence of the Persian monarch. They hired court jesters to make the king laugh. And anyone who came into the king's presence was supposed to keep a smile on his face so that the king would not be depressed. In fact, anyone coming into the king's presence with a melancholic look on his face could be immediately dispatched permanently in a box for raining on his parade. But despite court conventions, Nehemiah's deep conviction of personal responsibility for the walls of Jerusalem have gotten to him, and he can no longer hide the sadness in his heart. He responds to the king's question about his sadness. "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king said, "What do you want?" "And then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king." And that brings us to step 3 in rebuilding walls: pray. Before making any personal efforts to solve this problem, before even complaining about it, Nehemiah takes the problem to God in prayer. Jerry referred to this as an arrow prayer last Sunday, because all Nehemiah had time to do is shoot a prayer up to heaven. But I wonder if our modern technology wouldn't make this better referred to as a fax prayer. Get in a tight spot and fax a prayer to God. But I reiterate a most important point from last Sunday. That is that fax prayers aren't worth the paper they're transmitted on unless a person has spent time on his knees in private long before. The reason Nehemiah could shoot a prayer up in an instant of time between the time he's asked the question and the time he has to answer it is because he had spent 4 months in concerted prayer beforehand. Now, allow me to add one extra thought here. I think a lot of us use fax prayers only in the wrong situations. "Lord, help me make it through that light before it turns red. God, help me to find a parking place right in front of the stadium." Anybody willing to admit to that kind of praying? There's one honest soul back here in the back. One honest soul. You really think such pseudo-crises in our lives deserves the attention of our prayer efforts? Do you really think God is in the business of changing the time sequences of traffic lights in order to save us 20 or 30 seconds? I doubt it. But when a genuine crisis does occur, the one who has prayed up on his knees finds it the most natural thing in the world to say simply to himself, "Lord, help me in this situation." I suspect Nehemiah's prayer was simply, "Lord, change this king's heart." Hudson Taylor once said, "It is possible to move men through God by prayer alone." Sometimes we come to the places where there are authorities over us beyond our power to change, but never beyond God's power to change. Proverbs 21:1 says, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it like an aqueduct wherever he pleases." And what is true of king's hearts is also true of the heart of the irregular person in your life. Don't forget to pray. Now, the fourth step I see Nehemiah take is to establish a preliminary plan. During the 4 months he was focused on the broken walls of Jerusalem, Nehemiah wasn't stewing. He wasn't even just praying. He was also planning. The way we know that is after the king, after he told the king that he wanted to go to Jerusalem, and the king answered, "What do you want? And how long will your journey take? And when will you get back?" Nehemiah was ready with an answer. He told the king how long it would take. He told the king what he would need. He would need letters of safe conduct. He would need supplies for the building of the walls. He even told him he needed supplies to build himself a house. Obviously, he had spent many hours formulating a blueprint for action in case he was ever given the opportunity to go back to Jerusalem. In his best-selling book, The Three Boxes of Life, Arthur Richard Bowles speaks of the importance of pre-developing pictures in one's mind of the goals that you have. Pre-developing pictures in your mind. Thoreau advocated something similar. He said, "If you have built castles in the air, your work need not be lost. That is where they should be. Now put the foundations under them." A preliminary plan as to what you would do about your broken walls if God ever gives you the opportunity to repair them is a very important step. Imagine the results if Nehemiah had failed to do this. The king asks, "How long will you be gone, Nehemiah?" "Well, a couple months, a couple years, who knows? What do you need to accomplish this task, Nehemiah?" "Beats me. I've never been there before. How about just give me a couple of blank checks, king?" Do you think he would have gotten very far with that? We too need a plan. Should God allow us to repair broken walls, what will it take? What resources will we need? Where will we go to find them? What sort of timetable will it take? Who can we find to help us? Suppose, for example, that you're stuck in your career. You don't like what you're doing. What do you do about it now? It seems to me you ought to use your sanctified imagination and say, "What would I really like to do if I had my druthers? Am I qualified to do it? If I'm not, are there courses that I can take in nearby schools to get qualified?" Suppose the broken wall is an important relationship in your life. What caused it to break down in the first place? What changes can I make now to begin to repair? Do I need counseling? Is there any way to get the other person to go with me? Preliminary planning to repair. You see, looking into the future is critical. Not daydreaming, but planning. I remember when I was 16, or almost 16, my dad was teaching me how to drive. We lived near Wydown and Skinker, and he'd take me out on Wydown Boulevard, I think because there was a wide strip in between the oncoming cars. You know, he felt a little safer. But he noticed me kind of measuring my distance to the cars that were parked in the boulevard. And he said to me, "Mike, don't look at those cars. Look as far down the road as you can." I said, "Well, I don't want to hit these cars." He said, "The further you look down the road, the less likelihood you're going to crash with something up close." I think Nehemiah knew that lesson. He had his eyes down the road doing preliminary planning because he knew that the further ahead he planned, the less likely he would crash. Now, please note that I've called Nehemiah's plan preliminary. It's very important not to put a plan into concrete before one gets all the facts. It would have been impossible for Nehemiah to know exactly how long this trip would take he made an educated guess, it would be impossible for him to know all the resources he would need, but he made an educated guess. A preliminary plan is exactly that. And this is why step 5 is important. Set aside time for reflection and confirmation of your plan. Look at verse 11. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. He then takes a nighttime reconnaissance tour around the city of Jerusalem, looking at all the broken walls, the burned gates. There are places he can't even get through because the rubble is piled so high. I think Nehemiah is doing 2 things here. First, he's taking time for meditation and evaluation. You know, God is rarely in a hurry. When he needed a great leader to bring his people Israel out of Egypt, he sent him first into the desert for 40 years to prepare him. When God wanted a great missionary statesman to take the gospel to the Gentiles, he sent him to Arabia for 14 years, the Apostle Paul I'm talking about, to get a little education in the school of hard knocks. Nehemiah, exhausted from his trip, takes a few days to gather his wits about him. And I don't think God begrudges it. After all, these walls have been in a state of rubble for almost 150 years. A few more days isn't going to affect things very much. The other thing I think Nehemiah is doing is seeking confirmation of his preliminary plan. Undoubtedly, his estimate of the resources needed is itself in need of correction. A careful strategy for the building process is necessary also, and this could be obtained only by personal examination. Better to take time to get the facts and make an objective appraisal beforehand than to go off half-cocked and make some serious, irremediable mistakes. And after all, he is about to ask for a major commitment from the people to join him in the rebuilding. He needs to be able to say to the people, I've done my homework. I have seen the walls. I have inspected the gates. And I have a plan for rebuilding. Take time to reflect and to seek confirmation. I've been so impressed with the way our building committee has carried on the building process at Carmen and Weidman. Deliberate is the word that I think of when I think of this committee. I've never gotten the sense that they were in a state of panic, calling emergency meetings to handle this item or that. It's because they have built in plenty of time for deliberation, built in checks and balances, and the process has gone incredibly smoothly. Now, the 6th step that Nehemiah took in rebuilding the walls was to enlist a support team. And like all the other steps, this step is critical. There are very few major problems in life that we are capable of handling by ourselves. That's why God gave us wives and husbands and families. That's why he gave us the church. That's why he put gifted people into our lives. Nothing saddens me more than to occasionally come across people whose lives are in ruins, broken walls all over the place, but they refuse to seek help or refuse to respond positively when help is offered. Somehow they've developed the notion that it's a lack of faith to ask for help. Or maybe they're embarrassed. Or perhaps they have this strange notion that a mature Christian should be able to solve any problem just with prayer. Let me ask you, how fast do you think these walls would have gone up if Nehemiah had tried to do it by himself? You'll see in a few chapters, they built the entire walls around the city of Jerusalem in 52 days. How long do you think it would have taken had Nehemiah tried to go it alone? What if he had just prayed? Would God have built the walls for him? I don't think so. It's not that God couldn't. I think it's that God wouldn't. God rarely does things for us that he has equipped us to do for ourselves. But he wants us to do them while leaning and trusting in him. Nehemiah understood this and set out to enlist a support team. Look at it in verse 17. Then I said to them, the verse that I've given you in the outline is totally wrong. It's chapter 2, verses 17 and 18 here. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. They replied, let us start building. So they began this good work. I notice several facts about Nehemiah's ability to share his vision with the other people and get them to join in. First, he speaks in the first person, not the second, much like Ezra did. He doesn't say, you guys have allowed Jerusalem to lie in ruins. It's about time you got off your duffs and began to build these walls. No, he says, you see the trouble we are in. Come, let us rebuild. Secondly, he appeals to inner motivation rather than external motivation. He could have hit them with the fear tactic. If we don't get these walls built, our enemies could come in and kill us. No, he appeals to their self-esteem. He says, we're living in disgrace here. Absolute disgrace. The only way to resolve this problem is to rebuild. And thirdly, he gives all the glory to God. I told them about the gracious hand of my God. The leader who takes personal credit will gain a personal following. But the person who wants people to follow God better give God the credit for what is accomplished. And it worked. They joined in enthusiastically. The world might say that Nehemiah was lucky. He was at the right place at the right time with the right people. But a wag once said, luck is a crossroad where preparation and opportunity meet. Whatever your broken walls are, you need to enlist a support team. You may need just one very trusted special friend to confide in. You may need a small support group. You may need professional counseling. You may need a discipler to come alongside and keep you accountable. Whatever your need, don't be afraid to ask for help. Nehemiah would have gotten nowhere if he had not asked for help. And you will get nowhere if you try to whip a drug habit by yourself, or if you try to pull yourself out of depression, or if you try to get control of your personal finances all by yourself, or try to rebuild your marriage. You will get nowhere unless you are willing to use the people that God has put across your path for your benefit. Finally, there is the crucial step of perseverance in the face of opposition. Immediately after we are informed that the people began this good work, we read in verse 19, but when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you are doing, they asked. Are you rebelling against the king? Throughout these twin books of Ezra and Nehemiah, we have seen and we will continue to see that opposition rears its ugly head whenever the people of God start to do the work of God. It doesn't matter whether the issue is laying the foundation of the temple, disciplining sinning members of the congregation, or the building of the wall, there is antagonism and resistance, both within and without the community. And that is something God's people have to learn to live with and accept and grow from. In fact, Ray Stedman has defined a Christian as one who is completely fearless, continually cheerful, and constantly in trouble. Here the opposition is from three individuals whom we will meet further in chapters 4 and 6. People from the territory around Jerusalem who have a vested interest in keeping this city defenseless. They try two tactics. First, mocking and ridicule. And when that doesn't work, they use veiled threats. But Nehemiah refuses to give in to their intimidation. The God of heaven, he says, will give us success. Whenever you walk by faith and seek to lead, you will encounter hostility from people who walk by sight. They are rebuked by a life of faith. They are especially rebuked because they do not have the vision that you have from God. Now, in conclusion this morning, sometimes people react negatively to planning, thinking somehow that it is incompatible with a life lived by the Spirit of God. Nothing could be further from the truth. Chuck Swindoll writes, "I weary of people who call it faith when they can't tell you their plans." Have you ever heard an individual say, "No, we're not going to think this through. We're just going by faith. God will lead us." Well, let me say as clearly as I possibly can that faith is not antithetical to planning. In fact, faith demands planning. But our plans must begin with God, continue with God, and end with God. They must be in keeping with His will and His ways. You know, it's not by accident that we talk of the plan of salvation. God looked down at His people. Really, from all of eternity, He foresaw in His perfect omniscience, He saw the broken walls that sin would introduce into the human race, broken lives, burned gates. And before the foundations of the world, He established a plan to send His own Son to this earth to die for our sin, a plan that gave us the opportunity to have our hearts washed as white as snow, have our lives cleansed, our consciences cleaned, our lives rebuilt through His Son, Jesus Christ. Now, what are we going to do about the burned gates and the broken walls in our lives this week? If your whole life is a rubble, the answer is to turn to Jesus Christ and receive new life from Him. If you have already done that and you are a child of God, but there are still some broken areas of your life, what are you going to do about it today? I want to encourage each one of us to pick one gate or one wall in our lives. Identify it this morning. And then by God's grace, take these steps that are outlined for us here so clearly in Nehemiah chapter 2. And begin to apply them to that area of our lives that needs to be repaired. Let's take just a moment of silent prayer as we think with God about what that area may be. Let's pray.